content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again. This is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The date of this issue is April 15th, 2019. Cover story, The Test Case, Boundaries in the Age of Trump, by Nancy Gibbs. First, we go right to the page called For the Record in the early part, the beginning of the magazine. A one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing or a caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Pope Francis. And it says, Pope Francis describing the Virgin Mary in an April 2nd exhortation to young Catholics. The quotation from Pope Francis regarding the Virgin Mary, quote, She is an influencer, the influencer of God, unquote. In the right middle margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 66 million. Caption explains, estimated number of years since the meteor thought to have led to the extinction of dinosaurs hit the Earth. A team of scientists claims to have found fossils from that exact day, 66 million years. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Duke. A one-point loss eliminates the Blue Devils from March Madness brackets. Under Good Week, Duchess, a viral online baby shower raises thousands of dollars for Meghan Markle's favorite charities. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 34%. Caption explains, percentage jump and the price of Hasa avocados from Michoacan, Mexico, on April 2nd. Analysts said the spike could be linked to President Trump's threat to close the border. 34% spike, and again, that is a Hass avocado price. Michoacan. In the middle left margin of the page, a story illustrated by a quotation from George Clooney, actor, calling for a boycott of hotels owned by the Brunei Investment Agency in response to a new law in the Asian nation that legalizes the stoning of LGBTQ people and adulterers. The quotation from George Clooney, quote, Are we really going to help fund the murder of innocent citizens? Unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Barbara Bush, former First Lady, when biographer Susan Page asked her in 2018, shortly before Bush's death, whether she still considered herself a Republican. And the quotation from Barbara Bush in bright red, quote, I think I'd probably say no, unquote. In the upper middle of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in black and all caps, quotation from Farid Ahmed, a survivor of the March 15th New Zealand mosque attacks, on why he forgives the shooter. The quotation from survivor Farid Ahmed, quote, I don't want to have a heart that is boiling like a volcano, unquote. Capshaw goes on to say, Ahmed spoke at a remembrance service in Christchurch on March 29th. In the lower middle of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Janet Jackson, Grammy-winning recording artist, in a speech at the March 29th Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And the quotation from Janet Jackson, quote, "In 2020, induct more women," unquote. On the facing page is page one of the major introductory section called The Brief. And the headline is The Biden Test, The Democrats' Dilemma, by Nancy Gibbs. Whose standards will Democrats embrace? We all learned back on the playground that whoever makes the rules of the game stands a better chance of winning it. It's an uncomfortable lesson, one that requires us to accept that norms are fluid, that expectations shift, that people's actions are not only judged as right or wrong, but are also measured against the depravity or valor of their peers. Already, it's a lesson that looms large in the 2020 campaign. Will the Democrats choose someone who can play by Donald Trump's renegade rules, or will they gamble on someone who refuses to engage on those grounds? Which brings us to Joe Biden, the would-be Democratic front-runner, who presents the latest challenge to Democrats trying to decide whose rules to play by. Lucy Flores was the first woman to declare publicly that Biden crossed a line when he moved in behind her, sniffed her hair, and kissed the back of her head. Quote, "He made me feel uneasy, gross, and confused," unquote, she wrote in an essay for New York Magazine's website that launched 1,000 takes. Congressional aide Amy Lapos came next. She described Biden grabbing her head and rubbing noses with her. Quote, "I never filed a complaint, to be honest, because he was the vice president. I was a nobody," unquote, Lapos said. Quote, "There's absolutely a line of decency. There's a line of respect. Crossing that line is not grandfatherly. It's not cultural. It's not affection. It's sexism or misogyny," unquote. Two more women followed with accounts of relatively chaste yet unwanted physical intimacy that mirrored a flood of images. Unsolicited massages, too close embraces that spread on social media. It added up to a theme. Biden was getting too close to too many women far too often. Some Democratic rivals praised the bravery of the women who spoke up. Quote, "I believe them, and I respect them being able to tell their story and having the courage to do it," unquote, said California Senator Kamala Harris. Quote, "These individuals feel demeaned, and that's not okay," unquote, said New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. But both stopped short of demanding that Biden beat an immediate retreat from political life. Moving on, in the interest of getting more material into our reading today, we go to a companion article under the heading Politics. The headline is Biden's New Political Reality by Philip Elliott. Joe Biden has been gearing up for a potential White House campaign since last year, scouting office locations around Philadelphia, enlisting donors, and recruiting staff in Iowa and New Hampshire. In mid-March, the former vice president let slip to a group of union members that he might need their support, quote, "in a few weeks," unquote. Former Senate colleagues who have traded phone calls with Biden said they were convinced he was ready to run. But in recent weeks, Biden has seemed plagued by second thoughts, blowing past yet another self-imposed decision deadline. His pause has raised familiar worries. In 2016, Biden was close enough to running for president to tap a campaign manager, and a longtime aide wrote a 2,500-word announcement speech, Was he getting cold feet again? Biden insiders say no. He is likely to mount a third campaign for the presidency soon, two advisors involved in a rollout discussion tell Time. If he does, polls suggest, he'll be the front runner to win the nomination. But Biden's apparent hesitancy suggests he's aware of what else awaits him. In recent days, multiple women have come forward with stories of Biden touching them in ways they considered inappropriate. Biden denies acting inappropriately. Quote, "Not once, never did I believe I acted inappropriately," unquote, he said in a March 31st statement. Quote, "If it is suggested I did so, I will listen respectfully, but it was never my intention," unquote. He followed up with a video message on April 3rd that he would, quote, "be more mindful and respectful of people's personal space, and that's a good thing," unquote. Biden has long been famous for taking the traditional grip and grin of retail politics, a pat on the shoulder, a touch on the back, too far at times. His physicality has been the subject of late-night comedy routines, and the biennial swearing-in ceremonies in the Senate, which Biden presided over as vice president, were peppered with awkward moments. In the Me Too era, when the nation is re-examining the boundaries of acceptable behavior by men with power, questions about gender are certain to linger uncomfortably over Biden's campaign. But it's not just his handsiness that's taken on a different hue. The word is handsiness. Biden, 76, has spent almost a half century in public life, during which he's held a variety of positions that seem out of step with today's Democratic base. He repeatedly voted to restrict abortion access, and his treatment of Anita Hill during Clarence Thomas's 1991 Supreme Court confirmation hearings still incenses many Democrats. His support for tough-on-crime sentencing guidelines is now seen by many Democratic voters as unjust. And he voted for the war in Iraq. It remains an open question whether a party fielding a historically diverse group of candidates will pick a white man who on Inauguration Day would be the oldest person ever to become president. Again, we move on in the search of more material. And still in the brief, we are now in the section called News. And we come upon the recurring feature called News Ticker, which consists of three news items stacked one on top of the other in the margin of the page. Top item, Trump slams Puerto Rico as aid stalls. President Donald Trump criticized Puerto Rico's leaders as, quote, grossly incompetent, unquote, in a tweet on April 2nd, after the Republican-controlled Senate blocked billions of dollars in general disaster aid. Democrats wanted more funds for the territory still recovering from Hurricane Maria. Middle item, Venezuela targets Maduro rival. Venezuela stripped Juan Guaido of his parliamentary immunity on April 2nd, making it easier for authorities to arrest the opposition leader. Recognized as the country's president by more than 50 countries, including the U.S., Guaido has campaigned for months to oust strongman Nicolas Maduro. Final item, Georgia puts new limits on abortions. Lawmakers in Georgia passed a bill on March 29th that outlaws most abortions once doctors detect a fetal heartbeat, which can occur around 6 weeks into a pregnancy, and before some women know they are pregnant. The governor has until May 12th to sign the bill, which would be one of the most restrictive in the U.S. And the opposite page is another version of News Ticker in the right margin, again consisting of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Iran struck by deadly floods. Iran ordered some 70 villages in a southern province evacuated after 2 weeks of heavy rains caused widespread flooding and killed at least 47 people. On April 2nd, Iran's foreign ministry said U.S. banking sanctions reintroduced last year had impeded relief efforts. The U.S. rejected the claim. Second item, Trump threatens to close border. President Donald Trump, on April 3rd, threatened to shut the U.S. border with Mexico, marking the second time in a week he called for the drastic action. His initial March 29th tweet drew concern about the harmful economic impact of such a move. Trump argued that, quote, security is more important, unquote. Final item, underwater artifacts at Lake Titicaca. Archaeologists have discovered an ancient ceremonial site underwater at Lake Titicaca on the Bolivia-Peru border. Researchers said on April 1st they had found the remains of sacrificed llamas, ceramic incense burners, and gold ornaments, all used by pre-Inca peoples more than 1,000 years ago. Pre-Inca. Moving ahead, we are now at the milestones page. Lead item under died. Agnes Varda, or Agnes Varda. Nonpareil filmmaker. Observance by J.R. Time notes J.R. is a photographer. J.R. writes, when you looked at me and Agnes Varda, you saw a young guy and an old woman. But as I got to know her, I lost that sense of age. That's because she was always in the present, always active. Until her death at 90 on March 29th, she was planning what she would do next. She was in the moment, not in the nostalgia of the great life she had. That's how she kept making it greater. I was there for only the last couple of years of that life, but we had a friendship that was more than a friendship. She told me before she died that she loved the ride we had together making our film Faces Places, both the laughs and the fights. We lived something that we wanted to live fully from the day we met. She changed my vision forever. Wherever she would go, she would take a minute to look around her. You'd see her at the brasserie on the corner, and she would look at the table, at the chairs, at how the wood was aging. Agnes was the oldest person to be nominated for a competitive Academy Award and the first female director to receive an honorary Oscar. This is for a good reason. Agnes was unique. She didn't make any concessions. She liked to try things. She looked very far ahead, but also around her, in her house, her street, her city. Agnes Varda, filmmaker. Observance by J.R. This item is accompanied by a half-length color photograph. Caption says, Varda's career ran from new wave narrative to modern documentary. Under died, Nipsey Hussle, rapper with roots. Observance by Andrew E. Chow. When the rapper Nipsey Hussle died on March 31st at 33, celebrities paid their respects. Rihanna saluted him on Twitter, as did LeBron James and Ava DuVernay. Quote, I saw you as a man of respect and a don, unquote. Drake wrote on Instagram, quote, rest easy, unquote. But while the rapper had won friends in high places and accolades, including a Grammy nomination for his 2018 album Victory Lap, He was prouder of the work he did inside his own Los Angeles neighborhood, Crenshaw. It was there that he built a youth-focused STEM center, STEM, all caps, refurbished basketball courts, and started a record label that signed local artists. He was vocal about combating gang violence and championing black entrepreneurship. Recently, he bought a plaza at the corner of West Slauson Avenue and Crenshaw Boulevard, hoping to turn it into a hub of small businesses and affordable housing units. In a cruel twist, it was on that corner that he was shot dead, leaving behind a legacy of commitment to better the community that raised him. Quote, "All we demanded in our generation was that you be violent," unquote, he told Forbes in 2018. Quote, "In this era, we have to demand more," unquote. Andrew R. Chell writing about Nipsey Hussle, rapper. Under introduced, a bill to ban most semi-automatic firearms, including the type used in the Christchurch shootings, by New Zealand's government on April 1st. The law would take effect on April 12th if it passes. Under ruled, that an executive order by President Trump to allow offshore drilling in the Arctic is unlawful by a federal judge on March 29th. Under resigned, Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika on April 2nd, after widespread protests followed the 82-year-old's earlier announcement he'd seek a fifth term. Under unveiled, Reiwa, as the name of Japan's new imperial era, Meibu pronounced Reiwa, announced by the Japanese government on April 1st. It officially translates as, quote, "beautiful harmony," unquote. Reiwa, spelled R-E-I-W-A. Under overtaken, Apple, as the world's most profitable business, by Saudi Arabia's state oil company, Aramco, per an April 1st announcement. Under banned, and that is spelled B-A-N-N-E-D, under banned, most single-use plastic bags by New York, the second state after California, to make the move. Every county in Hawaii has also barred the bags. Under authorized, subpoenas for Special Counsel Robert Mueller's full report and underlying evidence by House Democrats on the Judiciary Committee on April 3rd. That was the entire contents of Milestones in the Brief. Moving ahead, still in the brief, we are now in the subsection called Health. And the new section called Frontiers of Medicine has the headline, "Why Breast Cancer Screening Regulations May Soon Change," by Alice Park. Getting a regular breast screening is one of the best ways to lower a woman's risk of breast cancer. Scans can detect early tumors and help women get treatment before growth spread and become harder to control. But for the nearly half of American women over age 40 who have dense breast tissue, abnormalities are harder to spot. Now, for the first time in more than two decades, the Food and Drug Administration, parenthetically FDA, is proposing changes to its mammogram regulations in order to better serve these women. The most significant change would require doctors to inform women if they have dense breast tissue. For years, doctors disagreed on what denser tissue meant for women's risk of breast cancer, since studies weren't definitive about whether it increased, decreased, or had little effect on cancer outcomes. But now, says Dr. Elizabeth Morris, chief of the Breast Imaging Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, quote, "It's very clear that having dense breast tissue is a double whammy. You not only have a small increased risk of developing breast cancer, but with dense breasts, it's also harder to pick up that cancer on a mammogram," unquote. Only 37 states have a law requiring that healthcare facilities inform women of their tissue status. The proposed changes, which also include improving the quality and monitoring of mammogram facilities, are open for public comment until June. If the update takes effect, the FDA will set a national standard for making sure that women with dense breasts are aware of their potential increased risk so that they and their doctors can discuss options for additional screening if needed. These could include contrast mammograms, which use a dye to light up just cancer cells in the breast, 3D mammograms, ultrasound, or magnetic resonance imaging, parenthetically MRI, can also help detect small cancers. Because of the importance of this information, your reader will repeat that sentence. These include contrast mammograms, which use a dye to light up just cancer cells in the breast, 3D mammograms, ultrasound or magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, can also help detect small cancers. All of these techniques can help women start treatment earlier to lower their risk of recurrent tumors. Quote, "The proposal is recognizing the density issue," unquote, says Morris, quote, "and shining a light on the problem," unquote. This item is accompanied by a photograph of a mammogram. The caption says, "Mammograms help doctors identify potential tumors in most breast tissue, but denser breasts make cancerous cells harder to detect." Also, a free-floating statistic is featured in the middle of this article. The statistic in bright red says 65%. Caption explains, "Percentage of women over 40 who had recent mammograms." That was the entire article by Alice Park. Moving once again, we are in the next section, the major section called The View. And the subsection here is Money, and the title is Sweeten the Tax Refund by Daniel Hemmel. For most American households, April showers bring May flowers and, even better, tax refunds. In 2018, roughly 73% of individual income tax filers received money back, averaging a refund of $2,899. In many ways, that's a good thing, but it also means that millions of households are together missing out on billions of dollars. Despite worries earlier this year about shrinking refund checks, the latest IRS statistics suggest that the share of taxpayers receiving refunds and the size of their checks are roughly in line with where those figures stood at the same time last year. This is encouraging news. Our tax system functions much more smoothly when the majority of taxpayers are due a refund at filing time. The catch is that the IRS does not pay interest to people who overpay, that is, who have more money withheld from their paychecks, or who make larger estimated tax payments than what they actually owe. This means that overpaying your taxes is equivalent to depositing your money in a savings account with an interest rate of zero. Some taxpayers have complained over the years about an asymmetry here, since the IRS does charge interest to underpayers. Why doesn't it owe interest to overpayers? They have a point. Indeed, there is a strong argument that Congress should change the law so that overpayers receive interest, giving them not just a refund, but a market rate investment to boot. There is more in the article, but again, we move on to get more material in. This article by Daniel Hamel, Time notes, Hamel is an assistant professor at the University of Chicago Law School. In the right margin of this page is a recurring feature called Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. It lists three excerpts. Top excerpt, The Bad Side of the Parks. The idea of America's national park system is not as wholesome as we've been led to believe, writes Dina Gilo Whitaker, author of As Long as Grass Grows. She explains, quote, the myth of uninhabited virgin wilderness has for more than a century obscured a history of native land dispossession in the name of preservation and conservation, unquote. The middle item, Beyond the Pay Cap. Psychologist Michelle Gelfand and doctoral student Virginia Choi demonstrate that people often overlook a prevalent form of gender discrimination in the workplace. Quote, female employees responsible for trivial to small missteps are subject to far worse penalties than males, unquote, including sometimes dismissal. Final item, imprisoning the innocent. Quote, bail reform presents an opportunity to have conversations about who we jail and why, unquote, write singer John Legend and New York State Senator Michael Gennaris, who seek to change the system so that fewer low-income people get stuck in jail because they can't afford the payment. All those items from time.com/ideas. On the facing page, under society, the headline is Why Therapists Break Up with Patients by Lori Gottlieb, therapist and author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. She writes, you may not consider this when you first step into a therapist's office, but our goal is to stop seeing you. In the bittersweet way that parents raise their kids not to need them anymore, therapists work to lose patients, not retain them, because the successful outcome is that you feel better and leave. But occasionally, we have to say goodbye sooner. The reason is what makes therapy challenging. We need to get people to see themselves in ways they normally choose not to. Of course, therapists aim to be supportive, but our role is to understand your perspective, not necessarily to endorse it. I'll repeat that sentence with more accurate emphasis. Of course, therapists aim to be supportive, but our role is to understand your perspective, not necessarily to endorse it. It's up to patients to take a good look at their actions. What therapists need from patients, then, is trust that we care about their progress as much as they do, and curiosity about the ways they may be unwittingly perpetuating their difficulties. If I seem to be more curious about you than you are about yourself, something's not working, and that can mean it's time to call it quits. The relationship works only if we're both doing our part. Entire column by Lori Gottlieb, therapist and author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Moving ahead, in the section here is World, and the headline is We Must Save NATO, by Admiral James Stavridis, retired. He writes, "Very few Americans could find tiny Montenegro on a map. Fewer still could offer a cogent description of the differences between Slovenia and Slovakia. Most can't name the three Baltic countries. Yet, thanks to Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's Charter, which was signed 70 years ago in Washington, every American is bound by law to defend with blood and treasure each of these nations and 22 others to boot. To many who lived through the Cold War, the alliance may seem like an obvious good deal. By binding Europe's democracies together, NATO decreased the chances of the brutal conflicts that dominated the continent through the end of World War II. NATO provided a strong counterweight to Russia and communism more broadly, helping defeat that ideology virtually without firing a shot. And when the U.S. went to war in Afghanistan after 9/11, the NATO allies went with us in their first and only exercise of Article 5. Most of all, for decades, NATO, the alliance for which I was Supreme Allied Commander from 2009 to 2013, was America's forward operating base for democracy, embodying shared values that were worth defending and even dying for. But even the Cold War is long over, and new challenges require clear thinking, not nostalgia. Originally conceived as its first leader, Lord Ismay quipped, quote, "To keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down," unquote. What exactly does NATO exist to do now? Its expansion to the tiny countries named above raises legitimate questions of common purpose and shared values. Russia is back and playing a much subtler role in undermining and threatening the organization. China's emergence as America's most powerful global competitor makes NATO seem anachronistic. Is the alliance, as President Donald Trump called it, quote, obsolete, unquote? The short answer is no. Many of the American interests it served in the Cold War are still advanced by NATO today. And walking away from the alliance will likely cost us more than staying and strengthening it. That shared fate is being celebrated in early April as NATO marks its 70th anniversary in Washington, with events including an address by its Secretary General to a joint session of Congress. But to save the alliance and advance the democratic values it was founded to defend, its leaders must take aggressive, creative action. The fact is, NATO is in trouble. The original alliance was optimized for the lengthy bipolar Cold War and had a relatively simple mission: stop the Soviets. It was a very costly approach that required massive expenditures on troops in Europe, around 400,000 at one point, compared with 62,000 today. But with only a dozen original members, and a few added along the way, NATO was relatively tight in both size and mission. After the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, NATO 2.0 began with a breath of optimism, sometimes described as a, quote, new world order, unquote, with the U.S. firmly in the driver's seat and the alliance reaching out in friendship to the former Warsaw Pact countries, including to the Russian Federation. This was a sort of springtime in European security when the idea of a Europe, quote, whole and free, unquote, and at peace, as then President George H.W. Bush envisioned it, felt distinctly possible. But a combination of Russia's increasing resentment as its former allies joined NATO and the global drama of the 9/11 attacks created a new reality. At the same time, NATO 2.0 began conducting counterterrorism and anti-piracy campaigns in Iraq, Libya, the Horn of Africa, and Syria, either through formal alliance missions or close cooperation among alliance members. These, quote, out-of-area, unquote, operations became increasingly controversial and damaged not only the popularity of the alliance with other countries, but also political cohesion within it. I felt this constantly in Brussels as Supreme Allied Commander, briefing the leadership of the then 28 nations. The air and sea campaigns in Libya truly split the alliance. The Afghan campaign, with its rising casualty count, appeared to be a quagmire. And later, debates over whether to have a formal NATO mission in Syria on the border of NATO member Turkey led to difficult sparring matches in the North Atlantic Council, the governing body of the alliance. It felt like the organization was fragmenting badly at the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century. If the avowed NATO hater Vladimir Putin, ironically, who revitalized the alliance and launched NATO 3.0, Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014 gave new purpose to NATO. I vividly remember attending an alliance meeting shortly after I took command in 2009, during which chiefs of defense of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania laid out a passionate, intelligence-based briefing on the possibility of Russian intervention in the Baltic countries. I assessed it to be a very low probability at the moment, but in the years afterward, I became increasingly concerned. We updated our NATO defensive war plans, conducted significant training exercises, and requested additional forces across the organization to maintain a higher level of readiness. Putin's subsequent actions, including the shooting down of a Malaysia Airlines jet over Ukraine and increased aggression in the air and on the high seas around NATO's periphery, drew the alliance together. But even as NATO reawakened, the challenge from outside was changing. Putin has practiced, quote, hybrid warfare, unquote, against his neighbors, the would-be NATO members, Georgia and Ukraine. A lethal mixture of propaganda, social network manipulation, cyber operations, special forces, and unconventional terrorist-like attacks poses a different kind of threat than the tanks and missiles of the Cold War. Could Russia make a similar set of moves on a NATO ally? Unlikely, but possible. And that threat only gets more difficult to counter with the advent of advanced military technology. As the tools of offensive cyber warfare continue to grow, making definitive attribution of an attack difficult to achieve, Russia might be tempted to subvert smaller NATO allies in the Baltics or the Balkans. Doing so, Moscow might calculate, could create fissures in the alliance as the larger nations debate their willingness to fight for a tiny ally. Over time, such a strategy could cleverly apply pressure to the real Achilles heel of NATO, its already shaky political will. It would be a smart tactical move by Putin, who seems increasingly prepared to bet that the answer to the foundational question, would you die for NATO, is, for many, no. President Trump is compounding that danger. He excoriated the alliance during the 2016 campaign and hectors the allies at every turn to increase their level of defense spending. That tactic, admittedly, has had some effect, as several allies have finally stepped up their spending to pledged levels. But it comes at a cost, creating resentment and division in response to the president's hostile and threatening tone. Worst of all, Trump himself has called into question America's Article 5 commitment on multiple occasions, most recently with regard to Montenegro. That creeping lack of common purpose poses perhaps the greatest risk to NATO. Signs of authoritarianism are already emerging in some of the allied nations like Poland, Hungary, and Turkey. The looming danger of Brexit seems to cut across the core values of the alliance. And the abdication of NATO leadership by the U.S., which for so long stood as a standard of democratic governance for the world, threatens the foundation on which the alliance rests. For all those harbingers of trouble, though, by many traditional measures, NATO remains extremely healthy. It is powerful. The 29 nations of NATO produce more than 50% of the world's gross domestic product, have well over 3 million troops on duty, operate massive combined naval fleets and air forces, and together spend over $4 trillion on defense. Indeed, even with all the frustration over European defense spending not hitting the 2% of GDP goal, the collective European defense budget is the second largest in the world after the U.S. and is ahead of China and Russia combined. It is smart. U.S. and European defense innovation and production provides a formidable military research and development capacity, particularly in cybersecurity, unmanned vehicles, space operations, special forces technologies, maritime and anti-submarine capability, and air and missile defense. NATO is a technology and education superpower. It is capable. The alliance boasts a large command structure of highly qualified teams of military officers from all of the 29 nations. Throughout Europe and the east coast of the U.S., those teams prepare war plans, conduct training exercises, monitor readiness of allied units, gather intelligence about potential adversaries, and run complex operation centers to cover the entire geographic range of NATO. These standing staffs, which we rationalized by reducing them 35% while I was NATO commander, can conduct prompt and sustained combat operations in a coalition structure on short notice. Your reader will repeat the main text in that sentence. These standing staffs can conduct prompt and sustained combat operations in a coalition structure on short notice. Just as important as NATO's health is the fact that we still need it. Geography matters, and the European Peninsula is particularly well located on the western edge of the Eurasian landmass. When I was Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, people would say to me, quote, "Why do we need all those useless Cold War bases?" unquote. My reply was simple. They are not Cold War bases, but rather the forward operating stations of the U.S. in the 21st century. When necessary, they allow us to operate in the Middle East and Africa. But they primarily serve as a bulwark. NATO is not global in its scope, scale, or ambition, and will remain tightly focused on the North Atlantic. Moreover, despite all the frustrations of coalition warfare, most observers would agree with Winston Churchill that, quote, "There is only one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that is fighting without them," unquote. The greatest single advantage the U.S. has on the global stage is our network of allies, partners, and friends. That network is under deliberate pressure from China with its One Belt, One Road competitive strategy, and from Russia with its relentless attacks on coalition unity. A strong NATO means not only having allies in a fight, should it come to that, but also a powerful deterrent to the aggression of ambitious adversaries. Perhaps NATO's greatest accomplishment is not even its unblemished record of deterring attack against its members, but rather the fact that no alliance nation has ever attacked another. NATO's most fundamental deliverable has been peace among Europe's major powers for 70 years, after two millennia of unhesitating slaughter on the continent. The disasters of the 20th century alone pulled the U.S. into two world wars that killed more than 500,000 Americans. History provides few achievements that compare to those 7 decades of peace. They were built not on the ambitions of cold-eyed leaders, but something more noble. NATO is a pool of partners who, despite some egregious outliers, by and large share fundamental values: democracy, liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, gender equality, and racial equality. Admittedly, we execute those values imperfectly, and they are stronger in some NATO countries than in others. But they are the right values, and there is no other place on earth where the U.S. could find such a significant number of like-minded nations that are willing to bind themselves with us in a defensive military treaty. So, what can NATO do to ensure the alliance continues to provide value for all the members in general, and for the U.S. in particular? What would a NATO 4.0 look like? The alliance should up its game in cybersecurity, both defensively and in the collective development of new offensive cyber tools. Geographically, the alliance needs more focus on the Arctic, as global warming opens shipping lanes and access to hydrocarbons. Geopolitical competitions will increase. We should taper off the Afghan mission, perhaps maintaining a small training cadre in-country and continuing to help the Afghan security forces push the Taliban to negotiate peace. There is work to do in consolidating the Balkans, where tensions among Serbs, Croats, and Balkan Muslims threaten to erupt into war again. NATO can continue to have a small mission there to help continue the arc of reconciliation. The alliance will need to be forthright in dealing with Russia, confronting Putin where we must, in its invasion and continued occupation of Ukraine, and at the same time attempting to reduce operational tensions and find zones of cooperation. Geographically, the biggest challenge ahead will be the Middle East. The NATO nations do not agree on an approach with Iran, which is an aggressive actor in the region with significant ambitions that will impact NATO. Developing better partnerships with the Arab world, which began in earnest with the Libyan campaign and continued into Syrian operations against the so-called Islamic State, alongside various NATO allies in the U.S.-led coalition, makes sense. Working far more closely with Israel would pay dividends for the alliance. And what of other tiny would-be members, the next Montenegros? NATO should accept North Macedonia to stabilize the South Balkans, then halt expansion. It should build global partnerships with democracies like Japan, Australia, New Zealand, India, and other Indo-Pacific nations. Should we be prepared to fight and die in a NATO campaign? Yes. On balance, the alliance still provides strategic benefit to the U.S. We should support this venerable organization, encourage our allies to increase their defense spending, and push them to operate with us on key challenges. We should demand that they help us build a NATO 4.0 that is even more fit for the decades ahead. We should also remember how dangerous the world can be. As NATO's Supreme Allied Commander for 4 years, I signed more than 2,000 personal condolence letters. About a third of them were to the grieving family of family members of European soldiers. I'll repeat that last part for clarity, with apologies. About a third of them were to the grieving family members of European soldiers. I visited the thousands of non-U.S. troops in Afghanistan often, and they were uniformly brave, professional, and motivated. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've gained much, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm your loyal reader, Randall Rickman, loyal if faulty. I'm reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you for joining us, and please join us next time for Time Magazine.